Blog Talk Radio.
No, fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. I think we're about at episode 115, counting the episodes that didn't air because they were private or practice episodes. So we're over the 100 mark. So I welcome you tonight to that whole part of the season where we are now more than 100 episodes into this whole venture of Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. Now we're going to do a little bookkeeping and housekeeping. I want to make sure that anyone who is I thank you, everyone, who are coming up on the board. Thank you so much. The new people and those people who are here for the first time, let me just acquaint you with all of the protocol that we have here. You're on blogtalkradio.com/ S is in Sam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, and the number 2. And if you ever want to come again and dial in, let me just tell you the number again. And if you're listening on your computers and you haven't dialed in, it's because some people do that because the board fills up, it's 516-453-6063. If you want to call in and ask a question, then you have to press the number 1. That will alert me, and I will be able to then let you on the air so you can ask any questions or say hello to myself or the guests that we have tonight. And then that brings us to this panel and the guests that I have tonight. And I tell you, I'm excited. I've been excited all week when they all consented to, when they said yes. It's exciting to have people that you've worked with and you've enjoyed working with them in one place. And these three people, all very talented writers, experience in writing different kinds of plays and different novels in one case, have always been a delight to work with. So I'm sitting and I'm looking at the news one night, and I realized for the first 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5.5 minutes, there is a consistent flow of everything that's happening in our society all over the world. And I thought, boy, how much of this is represented in the arts? And then I remembered that I had had the pleasure of directing plays from these three artists that had social significance. Now, they write other things, and most of them do have social significance in that the underlying of their work does show you or tell you something ultimately by the time you get finished with the play. But then some of the subject line that they had written about were directly things that we are dealing with today. And so I thought if I could get one of them or two of them, but to get all three of them, thank you, on this program tonight has been my pleasure. And I am so, so very happy to be able to do that because of the simple fact that everyone is so busy. We are coming out of a pandemic era. We are beginning to open up. And a lot of people's schedules are very, very busy. So that they have made time for me, I thank them very, very much. I will tell you their names all together, and then I will, in alphabetical order of their first names, I will introduce them. That gives my last guest who is here for the first time an opportunity to see how we roll, as they say, on the radio here. But the first two guests have been here before. So the first one that I'd like to introduce you to, I have to say I know her in two roles. I know her as a writer, probably more than two roles, but she's a good friend, but a writer and an And she is my producer of my book. She is the owner of Glue Heron Book Works, and which it specializes in memoirs, and I have that, and I've written that, and it was my pleasure to be inspired by her, for her to say to me one day, you have a story, you know, you should write a story. And I just kind of looked at her like, I was like, write a story? I don't know how to, I barely can write a sentence, you know. But before she finished, I had written a book, and then our relationship blossomed until she's a wonderful writer, novels and plays, and she brought me a wonderful play called Lois's Wedding. And we started talking about the possibility of doing a reading of it, and actually we did. And I have to tell you, she is the author of 7 novels, 2 books about artists, and the creator of the popular Swanson Herbinka mystery series. Now, she's going to have to tell me about that one, which is being adapted for television, and I'm so very proud of her. And her novel, Nude Walker, about soldiers returning from Afghanistan, has been optioned by Foundation Films for a feature film. So this is a very accomplished, wonderful, friendly woman that really does signify women working with women and that kind of sisterhood and solidarity that we look for. And her name is Bathsheba Monk. Bathsheba, say hello to the audience.
Hi. That was quite an introduction, Lenny. Thank you. And I'm waiting for your second book, by the way.
Oh, I know. Okay. Well, I've got something to write about now. Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay.
Well, thank you for coming on. It's always an inspiration to be around you. You inspire me to direct. You inspire me to write something down. You inspire me, you know, to be creative also. And your lovely husband is always there as an inspiration too, Paul. And I enjoy that relationship. Thank you so very much for coming in and doing this for me. You know,
my pleasure, Lynn.
Thank you. And, you know, Bathsheba and my next guest were both a part of a pilot that we did. And we're wonderful. I still, you know, I still have memories of how hard we worked on that. And I'm very proud of that relationship. Now, this next guest, well, you heard her voice on here a whole lot of times, participated in panels. She's come by herself, you know, in the time that we have been together. She has written a wonderful play about the human disaster of one of our American cities in Oklahoma called Greenwood, An American Dream Destroyed. And before that, there were about 40 other plays. But also, in the 7 to 10 years almost now that I have known her, in the last couple of years, she's really garnered some wonderful recognition from some organizations that I believe finally have awakened and do recognize talent. She was the first African-American writer to win the highest literary honor in Texas, the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Texas Institute of Letters, which was established in 1936 to celebrate Texas literature and to recognize distinctive library achievement. But beyond that, she was rewarded in 2022 a John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Fellowship in drama and performance art. Now, I can go on and start talking about her plays, which are Reunion in Borderville, there's Distant Voices, there is Sassy Mamas, there's Camp Logan, there's Barbara Jordan, there are plays about children's theater. There are mysteries. There are plays on black cowboys. It goes on and on and on and on. But mostly, like I said, with Bathsheba, it has been my pleasure to work with a woman who both of these women personify, working with women, women working together in sisterhood solidarity. And it has been my pleasure to have them to walk in the room, and my eyes light up when I see them. And this particular lady, I'm going to say her name now, is Miss Celeste Bedford Walker. Celeste, why don't you say hello to everyone?
Hello, everyone.
Well, thank you so very, very much for coming in and making this possible, Celeste. I know you're in Texas, and that is it covers everything. Now we've got Bathsheba, who is in the Northeast. We've Nicholas, who's in the greatest city in the world, as I call it, because it is the city that I was born in. So, therefore, it will always be my favorite city. We have a participant who is in Texas. So now I'm going to get to my final guest, this is his first time on the program. He is the only male participant today. He has gifted me with the pleasure of directing three plays that are, I think, outstanding in the subject matter, and we'll talk about that. It's a delight to work with him. It is a pleasure to work with the three of you, because consistently all of you are very dedicated to your work, but you are open to the progression of your work, and that is important. But let me tell you something about my next guest. He, like the talented ladies before him, he writes different things. He writes comedy, drama, young adult plays, and everything in between. His play, this particular play, I Thought I Knew You, which is one of the plays that I have had the pleasure of directing in, has won the American Association of Community Theater New Play Festival Award. The Best Day of Your Life is another play that he has. Comfort Zone is another play that I've had the opportunity to two character play that is absolutely, I would just have to say it, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And Bunny Boy. He's been published in 3 volumes of the Best 10-Minute Play series, and his one-act 10-minute plays and monologues have been produced all around the country. One of the things I can say about this gentleman is that, again, I have been blessed with the opportunity to work with someone who you can't wait to go into the room to start a new thought of the day. He's not always there, but he's always an email away. And I want you, everyone, to really welcome my new guest. This is his first time, but I hope won't be his last time, Mr. Philip Kaplan. Philip, say hello, please.
Hello. I'm here. Hello.
And thank you so much for the three of you all for saying yes to my big idea. As I in the middle of the night sent you all emails saying, would you do this for me, please? Because there was something else scheduled that I've had to reschedule, because I thought that it was absolutely important that we talk about how the arts is influencing people right now today. In the events that we see on the television, on the news, every single day. So I'm going to start by asking you, as a panel, and I'm going to start with Bathsheba. Bathsheba, you have written different kinds of plays. The play that I'm most familiar with is the one on fracking here in Pennsylvania, talking about that. Can you it slows his wedding. Can you explain to me what made that come to mind? Why? Why did you want to write about that in this, and the value system that you created in that play?
Well, I think like everything that, that all of us write, it, it was a personal thing. We very often, to get out of Allentown, my husband and I, we go to northern Pennsylvania, where there is, and Pennsylvania is a beautiful state. It's pristine in the middle. It's gorgeous. And fracking was just getting started, you know, I think by 2015 or something. And it was ruining our experience. And I said, what can I do? I can't, you know, I can't write a letter to the editor who reads those things, you know. And so what I do is I write fiction. And I thought more than a novel that that it would be best presented in a play. What happens when people sell out their land for a lot of money? And most people don't get a chance to make a lot of money more than once if they're lucky in their lives. And so what does that mean? How does that change you? So that was kind of the genesis of that.
Explain to people the whole concept of fracking, if you could, because then that begins to make them understand your concern about it, especially in Pennsylvania.
Right. So when in Pennsylvania, I don't know about other states, but in Pennsylvania we have air rights, we have land rights, and we have mineral rights under the ground. And so a lot of the mineral rights have actually been bought up by German companies, you know, like a century ago for coal. And that has stayed in place. But in the meantime, then they discovered that if they can frack, they can get natural gas out of some of these properties. And that's cheaper. It's cheaper than oil and all these other kind of energies. And so we were ripe. And so the oil companies came in and they bought up the mineral rights, and they started fracking, which is a very dirty process. They have to use a lot of the water, because so there's all these beautiful creeks and streams and rivers up there. They have to force it out. They use the water to force out the and break up. I'm not sure exactly the process, but they use it to get the natural gas out of the ground, and then and then they put it back. it's dirty. And so, but people, you know, it's a very poor area too. And, you know, and I think what started it was I was in a, I was up at Mansfield State University up there. And I was in an antique shop. And a woman, we were talking about fracking. My husband and I were just getting started. And she said, you know, I just sold my rights. And she said, what am I going to do? It's, you know, this is the only chance I have to, like, not milk goats for the rest of my life. So, you know, and so I said, okay, this is like a real issue. And I started thinking about it because I was so down on it before, but it's a human issue. And all of these really political things are these, you know, that, you know, if you're on one side, like I am, I'm very liberal, but there's a human side to it too that, you know, say, oh, we can't have dirty energy and all this other stuff. But if you're a recipient of, you know, to sell something that you own to get some money to make your life better, in fact, better than it's ever been, why wouldn't you take it? And so that's kind of the genesis of this.
I think that that has a lot to do with a lot of the changes that we have in this particular country. The opportunities, we have such a big economic gap. And a lot of people don't get an opportunity to move, to upscale themselves. And if you find that you are on a piece of property or you have found something on your property of value, that's the only way that that's probably going to be your only ticket away from this level of poverty that you have. I think that becomes, and that was Lois's wedding, that becomes a story within itself, the choice that you have. And do you make that choice, and then do you try to, once you've made that choice, make a difference somehow with the advantage that you have? Yeah.
Right.
It's
absolutely.
It's not black and white. And that's that's one of the reasons why I want to talk about it, because none of the subjects that you all write about are specifically black and white. There are a lot of elements to it. I'm going to go now to Philip. Philip?
Yes, here.
You belong to an organization that has decided to write plays about a specific thing that is happening now. Can you tell us about that? I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about, the subject.
Well, actually, okay, so what happened is, I'll talk about how Comfort Zone started. There was a group called Code Red. I think they're still around. And they decided, this may have been like 5-6 years ago, they decided that they were going to enlist playwrights to write plays honoring the victims of mass shootings. And, you know, at this point now, they are probably up to 5 volumes because, of course, as you know, the mass shootings do not stop. So I was assigned a play. You know, there was a shooting at a Planned Parenthood in Colorado, and you know, a couple of people died. And so I wrote a play. It's like I was trying to figure out how to not hit this head on. So I decided to write about it before the shooting. It's about the two people who are unaware that, you know, there's going to be a shooting in a few minutes. And, you know, so I did that. It went very well. And I had to invent the characters because I didn't know anything about them, and I had to change their names, but it's still dedicated to the people who died in the shooting. A couple of months later, my playwriting group, which was The Shelter at the time, we had one of these, everybody write a monologue and bring it in and do a roulette and have somebody read it, whatever. And I think the theme was Valentine's Day or something. And so I just ended up just out of nothing writing something about a man who had lost his wife, and he suddenly encounters somebody who doesn't know his wife is dead, and he just sort of, you know, just goes into a haze. And that sort of went on. And then one day I thought, hey, what would happen if these two people who both lost somebody met? And what would that be like? And that's how the play got put together. So the play ends up being about loss and about how to get over somebody's death from different things. You know, you have something, an older man, his wife dies of not necessarily natural causes, but, well, I guess cancer or something like that, versus somebody, a younger person in their early 20s who has lost their best friend through violence. And how do, you know, what's their life going to be like together? And then I came up with a contrivance to get them together, because realistically, they would have never met without me doing playwright stuff.
Well, you know, that's Comfort Zone. That's the convention that you created there. Before I get that, I'm going to go to Celeste, because I'm trying to get all of you, you know, to tell me all at the same time, so we have the foundation bit. Celeste, the plays that you have written, the one or two of them that I'm probably thinking about, Greenwood being one, Camp Logan being another, the circumstances by which racism has affected the lives of people. What prompted you to write that, along with the play that always stays with me, this is one that I have not touched yet, with only a couple of monologues from it, is Distant Voices. What prompted you to think about writing plays that dealt with the subject that we deal with today, civil rights, personal rights, human rights, And what did you want to say when you were writing that? What prompted you in your head to think about that?
Well, generally, you know, there's the saying that if history was told through stories, none of us would forget history.
Mm-hmm.
Because we would be able to invest in and relate to a particular character and his journey through a particular historical event.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's what I was thinking when I decided to tackle Camp Logan, the World War One military drama. I wasn't thinking it specifically, but when I look back, I think that must have been my thought process. You know, this is a historical event that has happened here in Houston in 1917. It's a story that I've always heard, you know, in the neighborhood. And it's a story that I wanted to tackle as a writer. And it was history, and I wanted that history to get out there. But in thinking about the best way to do it, I thought, well, what I think I want to do is I want to tell facts and imagined facts through characters. And so that was my thought process with Camp Logan, because I wanted a true acknowledgement of that event, you know. And once we have a true accounting of a historical event, of a racial historical event, then, and not whitewash it, then I think that, you know, we can deal with the angst that we have around race in this country. So that was Camp Logan, and that also applied to Greenwood, An American Dream Destroyed. You know that story, of course, because you directed it. It's you know, the tragedy of this prosperous black town in Greenwood, Oklahoma, and the tragedy that befell them when a white mob, jealous of their prosperity, came in and destroyed the town in 3 days, just brought it to, you know, complete rubble. So I wanted to tell that story, but I wanted to tell it through a particular family. I didn't want to stand outside of it and just tell, you know, about the events that happened, because it really wasn't about the events. It was about the people who had built this town, lived in this town, had pride in this town, and then this this tragedy befell them. So that was my process with that. I wanted to invest in a particular family and tell that more universal story of destruction and loss. And
well, you
then
know,
Distant Voices, it's a collage. It's a collage. It's kind of like people compare it to Our Town. It's a collage of people that were buried in a cemetery in Houston, Texas from the period of 1840 to 1970. So that period of time covered a lot of history and events. So it was more like a, like I said, like a collage of different stories, of different people. The dead came alive and told how they lived, how they died.
You know, I always think, when I hear about the degradation that happens in a cemetery, when I hear about people destroying something, or if there's a flood, you know, you think about how do you repair it and how all of the stories of each of those people there and what it represents. And Distant Voices always comes back to me because of that, as if it were recreating, we had to recreate the cemetery because it had been disturbed, you know? And as the recreation was happening, each one decided to tell their story, why it was important for them to be there, why it led them there, and everything like that. Now, Thank you, the three of you. Now what I want to know is the process when you are dealing with things that can be current, the things that, Celeste, say her name. There was an event, and you wrote a wonderful monologue about a young lady.
Oh, you talking to me, lady? Nene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mimi.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the circumstances that we were talking about now. That is that again is a monologue, a piece that was performed in a festival. That I had directed a wonderful actress in. And tell me, how does one take something from the actual news of the current day and bring it to the theater without making it sound like it's a documentary?
Right, that's a good question. Well, how does one do that? One does that with trepidation. Let me say that. For one, you don't want it to sound like a documentary. And for two, like you say, it's very current. Everybody knows the story. They see it on the news. They see it on the internet. So they know the story, you know. So you're going to suspend some disbelief. You're going to bring some fiction in there, you know. You're going to dramatize the story. But you can only go so far, and you have to be very careful because people know the story, and often the people are alive. Like with Nene, who was killed by police officers when she suffered a mental episode, her family was still very much alive, you know, and very much involved in trying to get justice for her.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I was nervous when I approached it because I wanted to give a true rendering of their loved one, but I also wanted to tell the story and want to, you know, dramatize the story, not just, like you say, just be a documentary or something that you read from newsprint. So it was something, it was a different kind of challenge. Most of the historical pieces I've done, you know, they're way in the past, so, you know, I feel like I have more license, but this was more of a challenge because it was current.
Oh, I think about, thank you, I think about Philip when I thought I knew you. And the storyline is, the subject of it, is a different spin. When I talk to people about it, I love Comfort Zone because Comfort Zone is the aftermath of loss. I thought I knew you, it seemed like it was the loss came was immediate in it. A storyline of the family of the person
mm-hmm.
who committed the crime and the effect on the family. How is that received? And you know, was everyone as captivated as I was when I first read it? About because we never think about that part of it.
Right. Oh, well.
Made you want to talk about the family of the person who committed the crime. What made you go in that direction?
Okay. Well, so what that play is, it was based on I can't remember the city. Somebody blew up a van in a city, and I think it was Memphis or something. And then there was a thing saying he did it because he wanted to kill the lizard people. And, you know, I hear this and I was like, oh, well, there's a play somewhere in there. What exactly, how do you end up believing in lizard people? And then I thought about this for a little bit and was like, okay, well, I need to really, what's the family like? What happens to the someone who who has become a known terrorist or something like that, and I assume they did not raise their son to believe in the lizard people, so that got down into what is the reaction of the family. Then it was a little more complicated because you have the family sort of dealing with this grief, but then how do I make a play out of this? And that is when I decided to bring him back. Well, first of all, I made this up. I mean, so this is all total fiction based on this thing here. But then I brought him back, and I thought it would be interesting for at least his sister to get a second chance to kind of like find out what happened to the thing, and maybe she can convince him to talk him out of it. And so I basically brought him back either as a ghost or as her fictional delusion. I leave that up to the audience. I don't take a stand on that. He might be a ghost. He might be just her hallucination. And that brought me into the whole thing about how does somebody end up with this concept that there are lizard people among us, and how can you talk someone out of that based on this? So I had in the play, I've got two parallel stories going on. I've got the sister trying to deal with convincing the ghost or the hallucination out of this concept, and then the family dealing with it. And each of them are dealing with their own way. And that's essentially the play.
Well, to me, I guess because I'm so close to all of these things, it made me go back to the families of Columbine, when someone would say, I didn't know that my child was doing all of that. And then you realize that the child maybe was in a part of the house that they never went down to see. You know, mm-hmm. they were busy with their own lives and thought that that child was just in there. It just made me realize that we have to pay more attention to each other.
But there is also I actually read the mother of one of the Columbine kids wrote a book, which I read as research for this. And, part of the thing is it's not just the parents, it's everybody. It's like, there may be warning signs here and there. But it's a very tough nut to crack. On these things there, because I don't, people were obviously blaming the Columbine parents for this, and they, could they have done something different? Maybe. I think a better thing about, the Columbine and other things was, well, how do kids get guns so easily? How do you get, all of these things on there? So there's a lot to unpack there, but the human element, of course, is you are going to be guilty. You are going to be like, what could I have done differently? And it's a very tough situation. And I don't know if I provide an answer in my play, but I don't think I can provide an answer, but I can at least bring up questions.
Well, that's the whole thing. I don't know if it's our job as artists to provide an answer. It's probably our job to present the situation and let our audiences, who we do not underestimate, who we respect a great deal, come to their own conclusions. Bathsheba, why a wedding? Why a wedding?
Well, I always write from the inside out. And so, like, fracking, like Philip was talking about, on the nose. You didn't want it so on the nose. And I didn't want to come at it from a town perspective necessarily, or from an official perspective or some, that kind of thing. So I picked the wedding, and Lois was actually my cousin, who was, as in the play, she was the most beautiful woman in the town, and everybody wanted her. And so what... And I'll tell you a quick anecdote about that, because it's kind of funny. When I was like 14, I spent the summer with her and her family up in the coal region of Pennsylvania, where my whole family's from. And you know how when you're young, you pair off with boys and stuff. And so, you know, we each got a boy. And then my guy, he said to me, you know, and he was very cute. I said, oh, this is very nice. And then he said, you know what? How do I get to Lois? That's all he wanted from me. So anyway, Lois was like my, you know, she was like the golden girl, you know, the one that everybody wanted. And so I thought, what if a girl like this would be in a town like this, and she could buy her own ticket out? What would happen to her and her family, and what kind of animosity would rain down on her, and how would she change, basically? Mm-hmm. So the whole thing had to be about her changing, her marrying into the family that is going to control the town now. So that's why a wedding, really. And I like weddings. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I'm trying to give the audience a hint because, you know, Celeste has just published a book, Sassy Mamas, that has Greenwood in it and Sassy Mamas and all this. You've got your book, Philip, you've got to get those published. You've got published work. Giving the audiences just a hint of your work so that when they walk away, they may want to find you all in libraries and drama bookstores to see what we really are talking about when we talk about these plays that are dealing with these everyday occurrences. How difficult is it to get the plays done? How difficult are you finding to get the plays done? And not necessarily the plays we're talking about, if you have other plays that deal with current events, what has been the reaction? And I have to say now, right now, because we're down at the 15-minute mark, we only have 15 more minutes left, so if anyone has any questions or if you're just listening, that's fine, but if you have questions, you need to press the number one so we'll have time for you to be able to get your questions answered. Now, I'll go. How difficult was it or is it to get your play done and the different interpretations of it? How do you find that part of being a playwright? Celeste, how about that? How about you?
Well, I think it depends on the play. The historical plays, especially black historical plays dealing with racial animus and incidents like that, it may be a little bit more difficult, you know, to get in the theater season except at certain times, like Black History Month. So mm-hmm. I've been fortunate, and I appreciate that in that regard, mm-hmm. that like with Camp Logan, we were always booked the whole month of February.
What about your mystery plays? What about those plays? And you know, and mysteries, the mystery play, I don't want to give it away because it's a mystery play. So if you give the mystery play away, then you don't have to go through the play. But it's a reunion and what happens at a reunion. Again, it's something that current that we all are doing now. A lot of us are celebrating reunions from when we were in school and high school and college and other institutions that we belong to. How is that received? Is that received with enthusiasm? Let me just say.
Well, people are more receptive because it is a mystery. It's a comedy mystery. So theaters are more receptive to comedies, and then it's a mystery, too. They don't get that many mysteries, especially black mysteries, with black black characters. So they are much more receptive of that. They are intrigued by it. And so it does open doors. And right now, you know, hopefully something big is going to happen with it. I'm going to have a big announcement to make about it quite soon, I hope.
Well, that'd be fabulous. That's fabulous. You know, Bathsheba, you have the historic, let me just say this. Swanson Habinko Mystery Series?
Yes.
Now, how Are they chronologically? Do they follow? Are they connected at all?
Yes, they're connected. They're absolutely connected. Mm-hmm. Oh. And so,
So it's like the Thin Man series.
Yes, kind of. Yes. Yes. Exactly. You have to know the beginning to know how it ends. Yeah.
Yes. It makes sense for you to do it in chronological. How many are in your series?
There's four so far, and there's another one that as soon as I get 5 minutes, I'll finish it.
I think I know that feeling. Go ahead.
Mysteries are fun. I like mysteries because they can be fun. They can be humorous, and but you can also tackle some big themes.
How do you market that? Do you market it in just the fact that you're writing, you've been writing plays, but they are like novels, correct?
They're novels, right, yes. It's a series.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I started my publishing company on. That was to support the rest of it. And it does. Mysteries do sell. So people love mysteries. Like Celeste said, and what's the Herbinko they want to know?
Yes, what's the Herbinko? Are you ever thinking about transferring that? Because, the Thin Man series came from a series of books. Do you think about doing that?
I am working with somebody, right now to make them into a TV series. And so it's been a process working with with the people in LA because they have different ideas about what should my hero and went from being a Ukrainian to I'm not sure what she is now, but she's been through a couple iterations, but maybe now that that we're involved in Eastern Europe, maybe she'll be hip again. Maybe we'll go back to the original thing that she was.
Yes. It's a different medium when it comes to that. The theater just kind of adapts where you would kind of most of the time gives you that license and you see on the stage what you write. But once you get into a different medium, and they have different demographics and goals and aspirations, so there is a change in it. So that experience has got to be interesting. Philip, have you experienced having your work transposed into any other medium or having any difficulty with having your work done?
In general, it's hard to get a full length done there's this issue. A lot of theaters are willing to do the premiere of a play, and but getting the second production is actually much harder because then it's just, there's this sort of things between like the really well-known playwrights, the Neil Simons, as it were, and then me. I'm on the bottom there, and a lot of theaters are going to go with The Odd Couple again rather than a new play that no one's ever heard of. So, I've definitely had some productions, and I have one coming up next year, which I'm quite excited about.
Oh, fabulous! And the productions that deal with the subject that we're talking about tonight more than any other subject. Do you find that it's received well? I know that it's been received well. How do you market it? Do you think because it's a trilogy, is it not? You kind of wrote three.
They're sort of related, similar things, but I think actually theaters. I think there's a sort of conundrum in that I think audiences like comedies and theaters like serious productions. So I think the I've had a little bit more luck with the serious plays than comedies. 10 minute, you know, that this is for Fulton. 10 minute plays, they do everything, and people and theaters are doing 10 minute plays festivals all the time. The problem there is that very often they will get like 500 submissions or something, and they have to pick 8. So
Do you find with those 10 minute plays sometimes whether they get done or not turn into longer pieces eventually?
I've done that with a couple. A lot of them are just, you know, it's just a 10 minute play. It's a scenario and it's over. But I have taken some other ones that I have expanded them. So it really sort of depends, and it's totally unpredictable. It's just whether do I like the character, do I like the situation, is it something that can expand, and is it something I can think of?
What about you, Bathsheba? Do you have any plays that were 10 minutes that you expanded, or that stay by themselves?
No, I actually like shorter versions, and I did one this year with Virtual Productions, so it was all on Zoom, and I really liked it. And they actually, I didn't direct it, somebody else did, and I gave them kind of free rein, and they actually cut it down even further, and it was better, and I liked it. I like a short form.
What about you, Celeste?
I have. I've had a couple of 10 minutes that expanded into 20 minutes, but I do too. I learned a respect for the shorter piece. You know, after trying to expand some pieces in the past and realizing, you know, a play just takes the shape and form that it takes. If it's 10 minutes, it's 10 minutes. Leave it alone. So I've really come to earn a lot of respect for the shorter pieces.
Well, I have to tell you that I've had many experiences with pieces that have come to me, and they were shorter, and they were right to the point. It hit it on the head. I didn't think that they had anything else they needed to say. But then there's a tendency to expand it, and sometimes, the expansion dilutes the strength of the piece. I'll go back and say, well, I'll do the play again, but I'll only do the short one. I don't want to do the longer one. I'm only going to do the short one because, for me, it's right on the nose. And we are in a society where our attention spans are shorter. So, you know, if you can capture that whole concept of delivery in a short period of time, and get your point across without losing any of the qualities of it. For some people, it's a good thing. That's why the 10-minute festival is so fine. Now, we're down to the last 3 or 4 minutes of the evening. I will say it again. You know, you all are here. I know you all are listening. One of the last question I think that I had, I had lots of them, but again, what happens is I have lots of questions, and then you all talk about things, and I want to follow through on some of the things that you talk about so that, you know, the one thing that I want, and I know we don't have a lot of time to talk about it, maybe we'll continue to talk about it there, is the process of the research. Philip talked about when he was reading about one of the historic mass killings. Start to tell me, and we'll finish on video and on air. Your process, how extensive is it, Bathsheba?
The research process, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, very, very. I mean, yeah, I just read everything I can about the subject, and then you find things in the research that help, you know, that jog the story.
When you decided to write about this subject, did you find that there were also people that you could talk to? Was it all book research? Were there interviews that you could make? And did those interviews, did they influence the characterizations that you created?
Actually, no. Yeah. It was mostly book. It was mostly book and YouTube research.
I see. What about you, Philip? You talked about some of your research findings. Was it mostly, did you get an opportunity to talk to anybody about the plays that you wrote? Did you talk to anybody who had that experience at all?
No. In fact, the I Thought I Knew You play is probably the one I did the most research on. I am a lazy playwright. I would be terrified writing something about like a real historical thing where somebody could go back and say, hey, wait a second, they weren't wearing buttons like that. So it's easier for me to be kind of inspired by something, and then I can imagine it, and then I do that. But for I Thought I Knew You, that one I actually did a lot of research on because I was really curious about how somebody deprograms somebody with you know, wrong beliefs, you know, and which I think is actually and getting into, you know, fake news and all that type of stuff. And mm-hmm. I did a lot of reading on it, and ultimately it kind of circled back. I don't know if it really helped me, but I did a lot of reading on it. And incidentally, here's one bit of trivia. Where is John Wilkes Booth buried? And the answer is no one knows. I thought I thought that was an interesting thing in terms of what they decided at that time, not to allow a shrine to John Wilkes Booth. And, you know, in terms of, you know, and in the same thing, we don't know where the Columbine kids, the murderers are. The parents specifically decided not to have them buried. So that's my research on that. But most of the time, I don't do a hell of a lot.
Well, Celeste, what about you? You know, I think we're going to continue on the video, but start that conversation about your journey of research.
Like Bathsheba, I do a lot of research, sometimes too much. You know, you just start to go down a rabbit hole. But, yeah, a lot of it. And it can really inform the work and give you ideas, you know. But mm-hmm. then there comes a point, I know Bathsheba knows this, when you just have to stop. I call it throwing fertilizer on the project. You just have to stop throwing fertilizer on it. And that's enough research. Let's get to it.
Yeah.
So you can deceive yourself, you know, that, oh, well, I'm researching. You know, I'm working. I'm researching. And so you have to put an end to it. I know Bathsheba knows about that.
Yeah.
See that? Philip, I guess you got the formula, so you don't have to worry about all that fertilization.
Absolutely.
Philip.
Well, with that, I'm going to say thank you very much to my guests. We've got just less than a minute. And we're going to continue this on the webinar. If you are listening and you want to get, you know, to listen to more of us and see us video, we'll be on there in a few seconds right after we close this down. And the link is on the Facebook page, Lenny Gottfried page. And thank you, Philip Kaplan. Thank you, Celeste Bedford-Walker. Thank you, Bathsheba Monk, for coming and spending this hour with me and telling me so much about your work. I hope to see you all in person soon. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lenny. Bye, guys.
Bye-bye, everyone. And I will let you know what the subject of the next episode shall be. Look out for it, everyone. Bye-bye now.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care.
To prove that mobile from Pantel and Data Business Voice brings the office everywhere you are, I'm disconnected with my team while falling 15,000 feet!
We're here, boss. We hear you loud and clear.
Hey, Janice! You know, companies today need affordable, cloud-based, unlimited calling, conferencing, mobile synergy, and easy upgrades to grow with your business to keep you, well, truly mobile.
Pantel and Data Business Voice. Anywhere you are.
Janice?
Yeah, boss?
Yeah, I'm gonna need a little help.
You dream of a career with better pay, benefits, and hours, but you're not sure about going back to school full-time. At McCann School of Business and Technology, we can help. We offer programs that are affordable and flexible to fit into your busy life. Most can be completed in less than 2 years. See what McCann can offer. Visit our campus at 2200 North Irving Street in Allentown, PA, or visit us online at mccann.edu.